20 Players, an album of forgotten sporting heroes. Number 7, Emperor Arthur Cartwright. Narrated by Mr. J. Motson Esquire.
In his heyday, which I suppose was the 1930s, Arthur Cartwright, or Ample Arthur Cartwright as he was dubbed, was considered a footballing genius. A man of such consummate skill, he didn't just make the ball sit up and beg, he practically made it nip off down to the corner shop and fetch his newspaper and fags. And don't forget, in those days, footballs were cumbersome great things, virtually made out of solid leather. Vince Taplow is an expert.
That beautiful brown colour that you see is got by boiling. They have to be boiled in a tank and boiled for 5 hours.
But mention Arthur Cartwright's name nowadays and you're likely to be met with a blank expression. Because for all his considerable talents, Ample Arthur somehow failed to realise his full potential. Never won those England caps. Never won that Cup Winners' medal. And unlike some other players one could mention, it wasn't a case of giving in to the temptations of booze, birds and the bookies. No, in a way, it was much more sad. Because Arthur's career was tragically blighted by a lifelong obsession with archaeology. His mate Percy.
It just means he was different. He was wildly different from everybody else. That's what one loved about him.
Arthur Cartwright was born in Oldham in 1910 to Charles and Enid Cartwright, a poor but hygienic couple with three children and an unusually large cocker spaniel called Pip. Charles Cartwright, like most fathers back in 1910, wanted only the very best for his young son, and spent all the hours imaginable toiling away in the local thermometer factory to put bread on the family table. Occasionally, a neighbour, Mr. Farrow, left them gifts of exotic fruit.
You put about a dozen and a half in your fruit bowl on the table. They look nice enough. You should think of painting them, you know.
But though all his self-sacrifice did indeed provide the family table with vast quantities of bread, Mr. Cartwright's overtime was a mixed blessing. Long hours and overexposure to mercury hastened him to an early grave, though not before he'd gone quite utterly hopelessly mad. Mrs. Cartwright was beside herself.
We're just decorating the stairs, you mustn't tell me things like this.
Luckily, Charles Cartwright had already impressed upon his young son the importance of a good education, and as soon as the lad was able to read, he devoured every book in the house. It's a shame there was only one book in the Cartwright household, a Moroccan-bound volume on Roman archaeology, because it balanced a wobbly table leg, and once removed, all the hard-earned bread rolled off. As was the custom back then, his sister Ruby ate the dirty bread off the floor.
They used to in my young days. I don't know whether they do now or not. Perhaps they're more refined.
In 1916, the young fellow was packed off to Mrs. Grimshaw's academy. No matter that he had a feeble-minded father and a diet unnaturally high in carbohydrates, Arthur knew more than most boys of his age about Etruscan high-glazed pottery. Needless to say, archaeology did not feature prominently on the curriculum of most Lancashire infant schools. Still, it didn't take long for young Arthur to display a talent for sport. Football, cricket, cycling, ocean-going yachting, he was easily the best at all of them. Hardly surprising, as he was the only child in the academy not afflicted with rickets, polio, and all those other terrible things. He also got incredibly fat, as the children had to race for their food, and Arthur had a keen appetite, according to the cook.
4 pounds of ham, there's 6 lettuce, 12 eggs... 4 pound of tomatoes, cucumber and cress.
As one of the few able-bodied boys in Lancashire, and despite being on the chubby side, by the time he left school, Arthur had attracted the attention of several clubs in the area. Turning down tempting offers from Liverpool and Manchester United, powerful teams back in 1928, he signed instead with his hometown club, Oldham Athletic. Collector Martin Smith has that original signature.
I can't help touching it and wondering who was the last person to do the same.
In truth, there was no competition. The Latics may have been a run-of-the-mill second division side, but Oldham had an archaeology museum, and they promised Arthur a part-time job doing menial things. As Frank Pelham, the famous singing fishmonger, recalls, the money was not good.
You know, they only got 11 months farther than an hour. I've seen the men going on with 5 shilling in their pocket for a wage.
Oldham's manager in the 1920s was Jack Hedges, a no-nonsense ex-welder with a fondness for portly footballers. At centre-half, bulky Arthur Bradshaw reigned supreme. Arthur Big Boy Fogarty and chubby Arthur McCandless played out on the wings. There were an awful lot of Arthurs about in those days. while Freddie Fat as Butter Jones wore the number 9 shirt. Jones later went to prison for doing unspeakable things to seabirds.
So we got the penguin stomachs, we squeezed them, and we put ready-made shrimp paste inside in there.
Arthur Cartwright's name first appeared on the team sheet in 1929 in a meaningless end-of-season clash with Middlesbrough. The 50,000 crowd watched mesmerised as he juggled the ball in a pre-match kickabout. Then, just before the start of the game, a message came through from the museum, reminding him he had some old pots to sort out, and off he went. His sister Queenie, who came along to watch, was very impressed.
It's a busy time, you know, while you're doing, because you must have everything just so, because it's a mucky mess, and that's saying something.
After much to-ing and fro-ing, ample Arthur Cartwright finally made his league debut in early 1930 against West Bromwich Albion. The great Raymond Glendenning, commentator par excellence back in the old black-and-white days, and a man with a very impressive moustache, happened to be at the match that day. He gave up his seat to an old lady.
That's very, very kind of you. Very kind. Very kind indeed.
Unfortunately, Glendenning had just returned from a skiing holiday in the Dolomites and was suffering temporary snow blindness.
I can see a faint white blur in the mist, but I'm afraid it's absolutely hopeless for me. Absolutely impossible. Nothing in sight of it.
Arthur spent the next few years dividing his time between Boundary Park and the older Museum of Archaeology. It was tragic to behold. Despite having magic feet and an equally magic archaeologist's trowel, he suffered from being a jack, or an Arthur, of two trades. Trapped in the familiar no-man's land twixt archaeology and football, it seemed that he was destined never to hit the headlines. But all that changed in 1938. Northern historian Jim Otterby.
That's 60 years on now, but there's still a lot remember it.
It was March, and his club, York City, were looking forward to a cup quarter-final against mighty Huddersfield Town. It was going to be the biggest day in the history of the club, and the players milked it for all it was worth.
Oh, yes, we've had so many as 20 and 30 around us, taking our photos. We've had our photos took over 1,000 times this summer. Yes, and we raised our Epstone, and how do you do, goodbye, and oh, they love it.
The streets of York were decked in red and white bunting, and the local brass bands had given all their instruments an extra polish. The council even put up fairy lights.
I would say over this area there are 5,000, 10,000 bulbs, and this is a very, very rare event.
Then someone noticed that the Bootham Crescent pitch had been completely dug up. The police were called, but they didn't need to look far to find the suspect. Arthur was found in an 8-foot hole in one of the goal mouths, pick and shovel in hand. Dolly Rigby, a local lass, saw it all.
The policeman what came, he was very good-like, but he was a bit wary, you know.
Arthur had started his digging in a misguided search for bits of ancient Roman pottery. In the event, all he found was a threepenny bit, which had probably fallen out of the groundsman's pocket. One of the policemen found another 2 coins.
And I was just kicking around in the soil and I saw the first one. And I found some parts of a pot, which we think they were buried in. So, you know, obviously someone buried them there and never collected them.
They were Roman and worth a small fortune. Not surprisingly, Arthur was dropped for the cup tie, which York eventually lost after a replay. As punishment, he was called in for extra training, which meant he was unable to complete his thesis on Phoenician petroglyphs. A pity, as it could have changed the world, according to someone who knows about these things.
I think it does key in very closely to the theme of the smaller unit in the larger setup today.
Although he could be bluffing. The following year, war came, when we fought against our old rivals, Germany. Luckily, it was all over in 6 years, and we won. When he went back to Hartlepool, his last pre-war club, Arthur found things had changed immeasurably. The town's fine museum of archaeology had been hit by a doodlebug. And there were no plans to build it afresh. That might have been the end of the ample Arthur Cartwright story, had he not had the good fortune to bump into Rach Dunning, a fellow prisoner of war in Germany and a man with impeccable connections in the world of sport and archaeology. So impeccable, in fact, that within a matter of months, Arthur was in the manager's hot seat at Accrington Stanley. His landlady remembers that Arthur was so shocked he went to work improperly dressed.
And he went out with one shoe on and a slipper on.
Which she found terribly amusing.
Oh, yes, we laughed about that.
Arthur was also given a job in Accrington Museum, where he sat on a chair and told people not to touch things. Frank Pelham was upset to see his hero in such circumstances.
It nearly broke my heart the first week as I walked up here. I nearly went home again.
Arthur's coaching methods were radical, to say the least. His obsession with classical history was the springboard for some unusual tactics, not least his insistence on sending out the lads in formations that reenacted famous battles. Skipper Dave Meadows knew just what to do.
Immediately I start playing, they will look towards me, and from the centre they will slowly walk towards me, and then the flanks will move in. They will gradually get into a trot, and they will form something like a half circle.
Mocked at the time, it's clear Arthur was tactically light years ahead of the field. Terry Venable's much-vaunted Christmas tree formation is nothing less than a reenactment of the Battle of Salamanca, where Napoleon's troops were thrashed by the Duke of Wellington. A man who loved a nice bit of roast chicken, apparently.
I think he'd go for the chicken portions with chips and peas.
He may have had the tactics, but at Accrington, alas, Arthur didn't have the players. The team got tanked most weeks. In addition, his constant disappearances on archaeological field trips hampered team preparation. And in 1951, after a dismal run of defeats, he was sacked. It was scant reward, according to Bill Shankly.
I mean, I'm not saying I think he's the greatest manager. I'm saying he is the greatest manager. Facts can prove that.
It was a double tragedy for Arthur, because in the same month, the local museum was closed forever. The council had discovered that no one in Accrington, with the honourable exception of Arthur, of course, had even the faintest interest in archaeology.
The public, city people, I suppose, don't like paying the rates extra to keep it going.
Ample Arthur Cartwright was a man out of time. Unemployable in the field of football, he found the world of archaeology was much the same, with museum after museum going to the wall in the cash-strapped early 50s. He disappeared from the public eye in about 1956, during Bill Haley's first tour of Britain, as a matter of interest, and went largely unnoticed until his death in 1970. Albert McClafferty, his next-door neighbour, was with him at the end.
He was the only man I ever knew who died of a broken heart.
Although actually it was pneumonia. Ample Arthur's funeral was scheduled for the sleepy churchyard of St. Walter's in his hometown of Oldham. His coffin was very prettily bedecked in the multicoloured ribbons of all the teams and museums he'd ever been associated with. A local lady had gone to a lot of trouble.
Well, I've got a process, but unfortunately I can't tell you exactly how I'd do it, because it'd be giving a secret away.
But fancy ribbons or no, Arthur was destined never to be buried in the hallowed grounds of St. Walter's. A keen-eyed gravedigger spotted some bits and pieces in the soil, which later turned out to be the remains of a previously undiscovered Roman fort, so Ample Arthur Cartwright was buried somewhere else instead. One or two people still visit the site, according to a spokesman from the Oldham Tourist Board.
The majority of people realise that the legend, the Arthur story, is legend anyway, and they still believe that possibly there was a connection with Arthur on this site.
It would be a fitting tribute to Arthur to say that this discovery re-stimulated local interest in archaeology, but it didn't, and all the finds were carted off to London, where they proved to be very unimportant indeed, and most likely ended up being dumped in a skip. No, Ample Arthur Cartwright's enduring legacy turned out to be his nickname. You see, Ample didn't really refer to his size, even though he was a bit of a porker, but to an ancient Roman vase, an ampulla, he dug up on a trip to Italy. It was unusual, to say the least.
On the top of it is a little red pinnacle, which looks rather like the head of a garden gnome.
This tiny little pottery artifact is still on show today at a museum in York, or possibly Thirsk, or Northallerton. So next time you're in the North Riding of Yorkshire, do check it out. It's the only lasting reminder of one of our most neglected stars.
20 Players was narrated by Mr. John Motson, written by Mr. Simon Bullivant, and produced by Mr. Richard Wilson of Broadcasting House. And remember, smoking blackens your teeth, so always take them out before you light up.